by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Libby Rains. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Shine With Q 15 years on Sunday, December 9th at 10:30 a.m. at the Portland Marriott downtown in Portland. Shine is the annual brunch and fundraiser for the Q Center, a place of resilience, strength, and love. This year marks 15 years since Q Center began serving the community. At Shine, there will be a cabaret, brunch, and honoring of Q Center heroes. Again, that's Shine With Q 15 years on Sunday, December 9th at 10:30 a.m. at the Portland Marriott, 1401 Southwest NATO Parkway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This 32-hour-a-week position develops and implements the yearly fundraising plan, develops promotional and press materials, and supports the anti-oppression work of KBOO. Send a cover letter and resume to Delphine Crescenzo at del@kboo.org or send to KBOO Development Hire, 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon 97214. Please answer in the cover letter the question, why is KBOO important? More information on the development director position is available at kboo.fm/developmenthire2018.
This is Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And good morning, good morning. You are listening to KBOO, your very own community radio station. I'm Ani, and this morning we have a discussion lined up for you that centers on the question of civility in public discourse, that also brings into view accountability, forgiveness, and, well, looking at some vastly differing attitudes around the legacy of George H.W. Bush, but expanding that question into resistance and civility in general. What is acceptable to actually resist fascism? What is acceptable to actually be a part of a movement for positive social change when we are in fact confronting people who negate decades of precedents on human rights and, you know, war crimes, that sort of thing? That's what we got lined up for you this morning. And joining me right now by phone, we have David Haseltine. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Ani. Good to be with you.
It's really good to have you. David is a community activist and is here to join me in the conversation, specifically around Bush's legacy. And thank you so much for making the time to do that. So this week, we have heard some incredible press accounts and remembrances to George H.W. Bush, who died last Friday. The corporate press and social media began pouring out condolences to who they called a great and noble man. They've called him a great statesman, a good family man, and praised him. His biographer, who gave one of the eulogies at the state funeral, called him America's last great soldier statesman, a 20th century founding father. All right, well, those are some ways to know George H.W. Bush. Some of us knew a very different man, right, David? I mean, we hear about lovable Grampy Bush from his grandson at the second funeral in Houston. But some of us, instead of knowing Grampy Bush, the noble statesman, we knew Bush as the former director of the CIA, an agency that's been long involved in torture and American hegemony, advanced under assassination programs. We remember him as the president that orchestrated the invasion of Panama. We remember him as the president that gave us the 1991 edition of the Gulf War, the effects of which we're still feeling, both globally as well as with the vets who served. This was also the president who was unresponsive during one of the largest public health crises in the last 100 years, being the AIDS epidemic. So, David, how are you feeling this morning when you're thinking about the legacy of George H.W. Bush? What comes to your mind, first of all, when you're remembering this president?
Well, I am a gay man, and so really what you just touched on with the AIDS epidemic and HIV, that is what comes to mind to me. And, you know, from really his time in the Reagan administration, just joking about it with reporters and the Washington Press Corps and you know, really just making it a mockery of, you know, what was really killing people, and then in his own administration, banning HIV-positive people from coming to the United States, preventing the CDC from really doing any meaningful public health work that would address the epidemic, that this man has quite a lot of blood on his hands in terms of our community. And I'm feeling frustrated because I am noticing a lot of you know, gay men in the community saying, you know, well, at least he wasn't Trump or he wasn't that bad. And I think it's really remarkable because, you know, this, if I were maybe 20 years older, it would be impossible for us to really talk about that because we probably wouldn't be here. You know, there's almost an entire generation of gay men that just simply aren't here because of this man's policies.
And that's a really powerful statement when you're making that statement. It's, you know, the fact that there is the better part of a generation of gay men missing, right, because of the actively aggressive policies given to the CDC to not further research on HIV and transmission and to look at treatments that were effective. We're talking about really the responsibility of the death of huge parts of the community. And I just want to underscore that. So when we hear that, you know, well, yeah, but now he's dead and we have to have compassion for his family who are in deep mourning. And therefore, you know, we cannot actually critique his legacy. How does that strike you?
It doesn't really carry much currency with me. I had no personal relationship with George H.W. Bush. He was not my father or grandfather. And, you know, there's this great effort to humanize him with his, yeah, like you say, with his silly socks or his giving a candy to Michelle Obama at the McCain funeral, what have you. But this is not a private figure. This is a public figure who led a very public life and whose, you know, the impact of that life had very broad implications for people that if it can't be examined upon his death, at what point is it acceptable? You know, and it just seems that there's a lot of effort that maybe it's never acceptable. If we can't talk about it now,
right.
When it's meaningful, when it's effective, when it's timely, at what point does it become, you know, how much time needs to pass before we can actually take a critical examination of this man's actions and take stock of this life and how it impacted people? When is that allowed? I don't really understand that.
Absolutely. I am with you. And I bet there's some listeners out there who would also like to join us in this conversation. Let me go ahead and give that number out. It's 503-231-8187 is the number to call in this morning with your questions, with your comments. Looking at, it seems actually like the only thing you need to do to be forgiven of all sins as, you know, somebody who is on the wrong side of history, near as I can see, you know, the only thing that needs to happen to wipe out all accountability is you just need to die. And suddenly you become canonized. You are now the new saint of 20th century politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a bit like a sort of a baptism, really, that you're just absolved of everything. And, you know, especially in the age of Trump, you really don't have to be very good. You just have to not be
Trump,
you know, as rude or as coarse as he is. And you'll be lionized on the left and the right by anyone who seems to have this a very strange fetish for the politics of civility.
And I like the way you put that, actually, David. It's and we can expand that to be covering so many other things that have happened over the last couple of years. I think that the Bush the Elder's funeral has it just sort of made my head explode a little bit. And I started thinking about all of these other moments over the last couple of years where people have actively spoken loudly against administration officials because of their policies, because of the policies of the current administration, who have confronted them in public places. And I think, you know, two of the most famous examples were with Kirstjen Nielsen, who was booed out of a Mexican restaurant shortly after it came to light that the current administration is separating families at borders and creating toddler detention centers. But somehow or another, we are supposed to respect her private family time, even as she's actively promoting policies that destroy families for other people.
Right, and it's a very strange focus on that sort of public demonstration. I think, you know, that sort of engagement with politicians and people in the administration is great. It's good. These people should be held accountable wherever it is they are. And, you know, to look at a situation like that and focus on it and say, well, you know, we must be deferential to their enjoyment of a fancy dinner. I don't understand if, you know, the worst thing that happens to you in your day is that your dinner's interrupted. You know, you're doing a pretty okay. If you're being separated from your family and being removed from the only home you've known for 30, 40 years, you know, that's pretty disruptive and that's pretty awful. And that seems to be where the focus should be. But those people's stories aren't told because they're not members of the political class in this country.
Absolutely. Well, we have a caller joining us. Let's go ahead and get right with them. Good morning, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I have to thank KABU again, especially for this last week. As if living through an election where our choices were Trump and Hillary Clinton wasn't alienating enough, this last week, I don't know about you two, but I just feel like I'm living in an alien land, like I'm behind enemy lines or something.
Yeah.
But my comment, I guess, would be the whole idea of a Green New Deal, that's not even new. Like, a lot of people were talking about in the early 90s a peace dividend.
Right.
I think it was the Urban League and Jesse Jackson and Rainbow Push. They were talking about massive infrastructure rebuilds along the lines of a Green New Deal from the peace dividend. And not only did Bush squander that in foreign policy, instead of having like a Marshall Plan that would have helped the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, say, transition to a more social democratic society, he sent economists who, and this is their language, instituted quote-unquote shock therapy economic policies, virtually guaranteeing a Putin-like figure to arise. So if you throw that in with the Vietnam syndrome, Bush's own language, that he was gloating over the fact that he got rid of the Vietnam syndrome, where the American people didn't want to have interventions all over the world. You know, the only president I can think of that was any worse than Bush was Bill Clinton, who actually implemented much of the Reagan-Bush agenda, like NAFTA and the crime bill and all that stuff. So I'll leave it at that and listen to your comments off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much, Sean. Do you have any response to that, David?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually foolishly turned on National Public Radio on, I think it was Wednesday, for a bit, just to see, you know, my local station down here in San Francisco is KQED, wanted to hear the news, and it turns out they were running the Bush funeral in its entirety. And I don't know who was eulogizing him, but they were talking about, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union and how George H.W. Bush was responsible for the transition of Russia into a functioning democracy. And I was gobsmacked. I'm like, this is not even remotely true that Russia is a functioning democracy. And, you know, if we can't be critical of someone who has just passed, surely we don't need to be telling like absolute falsehoods about their record.
Absolutely. And again, in looking at transition to the democracy in Russia that, again, we've heard about but maybe not actually seen in reality, the oppression of the LGBTQ population in Russia is absolutely obscene. It is, you know, where the far right in this country, I think, would like to see us go. But happily, we have continued to resist. So just to bring that in, too, let's go ahead and take our next caller. Barth, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is a very useful discussion. I found myself talking positively about the passing of the president, and you know, at least he wasn't Trumpish at all. You know, he was presidential. He was articulate. He was actually intelligent. But I'm happy to be reminded and illuminated about the other parts of his life, which have largely fallen out of my conscious memory. There was a cowboy movie called Will Penny, which starred Charlton Heston. And in the movie, he comes across a cowboy who has fallen off his horse and is, in fact, dead, and puts him on his horse and rides him to the nearest ranch, and everybody's pretty suspicious of him. And he says, well, I just found him this way, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great movie. But the line that's important here is, well, isn't that always the way? And one of the people's response, well, what do you mean, what way? And he says, well, here he is dead, and now he's good old Claude, but I wonder how he was before he died.
Yeah. It's a pretty telling sentiment, I think, right?
Indeed.
Thanks very much for your call, Barth.
Let you go. Good day.
I think that one of the things that we've all touched on this morning and over the last week is so many people are saying, yeah, but at least he's not Trump. How low have we lowered the bar to be interpreted as a good statesman? You know, because you are not this buffoonish character who is actively imposing fascism, because you're not that, suddenly you're good. And that kind of blows my mind.
But if you really take a look at you know, the policies of someone like George Bush from the, you know, the more establishment wing of the Republican Party, and someone like Donald Trump, there isn't really a tremendous amount of difference of opinion. And Donald Trump doesn't really have this grand political vision. He's just sort of an empty vessel that the GOP has sort of put their policies into. And so what I'm seeing from folks is not so much that George Bush is so much better in terms of policy. It's just that he's the right kind of Republican. He's a polite fascist, and it's really not that he was any better. It's just that, you know, he doesn't use coarse language, or he doesn't speak with like a tough New York accent to call people names.
Right. And again, like, wow, that's the best we can expect.
Right.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm Ani. I'm your host this morning. Positively Revolting is the show you're listening to on KABU, your community radio station. My guest on the phone this morning is David Hazeltine, who is a community organizer in San Francisco. And we are talking about civility. We are talking about accountability and forgiveness, looking at a case in point of the passing of George W. Bush. George H., sorry, H.W. Bush. Got to get all of those initials in there. We have so many other points to bring in. Again, we invite your call at 503-231-8187. You can also follow along during the week on Twitter, where you can find Positively Revolting at Positive Revolt. You can also find us on Facebook, Positively Revolting. The politics of civility, you know, again, we talked about being booed out of a restaurant. There's the famous case of Sarah Huckabee Sanders not being served at a small restaurant when she went to have dinner with her family, because the staff of the restaurant all agreed that they did not, they were in such opposition to the practices of the administration, for whom she is the mouthpiece, that they thought that this was an act of resistance. They would not serve her in a private setting, or, you know, public setting as a restaurant might be. And we heard the outcry, right? And we heard Maxine Waters say that this is good and right behavior, that when the policies of an administration are hurting the public, are destroying families at the borders, are carrying on mass incarceration, are denying basic infrastructure, are bringing back fascism, all of these things, and we hear such a loud cry that, oh, well, you know, this is an outrage, that Maxine Waters speaking plain truth is an outrage, that basically the overarching message that I was picking up is we have to learn our place. Even if you're an elected representative like Maxine Waters, she is a black woman, and she is speaking loud and plain truth about, you know, I'm going to say white men, about an administration that actually actively supports white supremacy, and sexual assault, for that matter. You know, it's, to me, directly a message that the resistance have to learn our place. We are the underclass, we are the rabble, and we have to be polite even as we're being crushed. Would you?
Right. And too many folks on the quote unquote mainstream left in this country actually buy into it. I mean, how dumb do you have to be to listen to your opponent tell you like what form of demonstration or protest or action is acceptable and which is not? The reason they don't like it is because it's effective. And so, you know, I've always found that the establishment is always going to be very, pearl clutching and morally outraged by whatever form of protest is effective. And so I just don't really understand why anyone would listen to them. You know, these are the people that are, you know, your opposition. They're actively, you know, looking to harm you. I don't think we owe them our ear when they say, oh, you know, you have to behave in such a way. But yes, I do think that it does come from a position that certain folks of a certain class and a certain wealth and a certain privilege are, you know, entitled to behave in a certain way and
you know, they don't really live in a parallel justice system or anything like that. Mm-hmm. They have their own rules for themselves. And then the rest of us have to, yeah, we sort of have to be very deferential and go along with it and make sure that, you know, their fancy dinners are peaceful and good and all that.
And we also, I mean, have at the head of the country, like it or not, we have this guy who at rallies actively called for his supporters to knock the crap out of people that were there in any kind of resistance. And then furthering saying, yeah, knock the crap out of them. I'll pay your legal fees. I promise. But,
right. And, well,
but
I think
that's
a,
okay.
A lot of people, I think a lot of mainstream like talking head folks are just exhausted with Trump. And they don't care anymore. They're just sort of like, you know, he's going to do what he's going to do. And you can't really correct the behavior. But on the other hand, the rest of us, you know, we need to be very deferential to the memory of a man who's died, because, you know, it's, his family is upset, you know.
Absolutely. And I want to give that number again. It's 503-231-8187. Go ahead, give us a call and let us know how you're feeling about the calls for an ahistoricism in remembering Bush the Elder, and what you're thinking about the politics of civility in general. I find it to be extremely classist, and it's just not even it's not even code for shut the heck up. We're in charge. You're gonna just sort of, you know, if you don't like it, please walk up and down a sidewalk holding a sign quietly, and make sure your sign is nicely printed and doesn't have any you know, naughty words in it.
Right.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. One thing I wanted to add, Ani, is that as we, you know, experience these calls for civility in the wake of George H.W. Bush's death, something I read and I thought it was really rather remarkable is that they, you know, we really see this effort to try to humanize him and normalize him and just say, you know, he's just like you and me. When innocent black men in our cities are gunned down by the police, they are not afforded the same courtesy. Every aspect of their life, anytime they jaywalked or, you know, maybe got a bad grade in school, is combed over by the news media. And, you know, when 17-year-old Trayvon Martin murdered by George Zimmerman in Florida, it was like, well, what was he wearing? You know,
right.
He had a hoodie on, or, you know, he was acting aggressively, or this or that. And, you know, you often see this quote, like, you know, he was no angel. And it's just not a courtesy that people in, you know, the lower classes are afforded, that, you know, George H. Bush is getting and John McCain got when he died, you know.
Yeah, and I think that that is actually a super important point. Anytime, you know, anytime you hear of black men being killed, and it's exactly that. We see, we don't see graduation pictures. We don't see pictures of them actively serving in the military. In fact, you know, the most recent case of the good man with a gun being killed by the cops at the mall shooting, right? We saw the cops actively say he was the shooter. The thing is taken care of. And then a little bit, maybe a little back walking the next day when they realized, no, you know, they realized it a lot beforehand, but still the initial outcry was there. The initial pictures were there of not showing this man in his service uniform who was home on a Thanksgiving break. It was astonishing in that this is the normal, right? That's the astonishing part to
right.
me. That immediately, especially people of color, especially black men, are demonized, and we look for justifications. The press looks for justifications of why the police killed them, and not who these people are. They are not afforded any kind of civility that now, as a nation, we are told we must apply to war criminals and to a man responsible, as you said, for the deaths of the better part of a generation of gay men. It's the hypocrisy of that makes my head spin around.
Same.
Okay. I want to remind people that you're listening to KABU, your community radio station. At 9 o'clock, Pacific Underground welcomes Peter Tarias and talks about his alternative history novels, United States of Japan, and Mecha Sumerai Empire. At 10 o'clock, Valley Views is celebrating its first anniversary on KABU with stories about the show's origins and plans for a future format. At 10:15, you'll hear Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, a Radio Geekly looks back at the life of publisher Stan Lee. They're visiting also the local holiday craft fair, Geek the Halls, and a visit to the D&D pop-up tavern, Orcs, Orcs, Orcs. All of these programs are made possible by your support. Dear members, please do become a member of KABU today. You can go to kboo.fm and go ahead and click the donate and join us. Join us. Support this programming. And we're going to welcome our next caller to the air. Good morning, Melanie.
Hi.
Good morning.
How are you?
We're doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Well, thank you for opening it up because this is something that very much needs to be talked about how we're canonizing war criminals, people who make such devastating decisions to undermine entire nations in our world, in our and it's incredible to me that we have very little pushback when these people die. I kind of wonder, what do people think when Kissinger finally kicks the bucket? Are we going to be doing the same thing? Are we going to be shutting things down for another war criminal? Are we going to be canonizing more and more of them? We did the same thing for John McCain. You know, it's not about the presidency anymore once they're out. It's what they do and what they did that we have to constantly reflect on. And every single presidency after them is about trying to make ourselves better. And when we have presidencies continue on in the same vein of creating massive war and death amongst our global family, I have to wonder, you know, just what kind of nation are we trying to say we are? We can't say that we're about any form of freedom or liberation of any kind when our leaders, when they die, that that they aren't still held accountable. And at some point, when do we actually start getting them in front of some courts while they're still alive? And
An
that needs
question.
To be changed.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Melanie, for your call this morning.
Thanks.
503-231-8187. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
I, for one, am not going to shed no tears over the loss of George Bush. I think he was not such a great president at all. But I got to tell you one thing, though. I cringe every time you guys say white men do this, white men do that, because I'm white and I don't see myself doing that. And I've traveled a lot around the world and worked in many cultures, and the male supremacy thing seems to be pretty common, whether it's white, black, Indian, whatever it might be. You know, it's not just white men, it's men.
And yet, we're in this country is where we're talking about right now, right? And so, in this country,
even in this country, it's pretty integrated now.
I know, not all men.
It's more and more integrated.
But here's the thing, Tim. Let me just respond to that for a moment. I appreciate your point, and it's one I've talked with a lot of folks before. And let me just say, in this country, you're having the crossroads, right? You're having the Venn diagram of white supremacy and male supremacy. We're looking at a power structure. We understand that there are many, many people who are, in fact, white and male who are doing good things in the world. That's okay. I'm a white woman. You know, when I talk about white people have problems, I realize I am a white person. And it's important to me to actually be very self-reflective, and to actually listen to people of color when they're talking about how this oppressive power structure, how the systemic oppression of people of color plays out in this society. I know that I have a very important role to play in talking to other white people about how to take that power structure down. Right? And so, again, I'm going to put it out to you. You have a very important role to play reaching out and talking to other white men about how to take this power structure down. And that's what we're talking about. Cool. So, yeah. You know, wear the shoe as much as it fits you.
But I'm thinking long-range social change,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
If you want to be inclusive, because if there's going to be equality and justice for all and freedom and everything, that has to include white people as well as black people and colored people and what, and men and women and straight and gay and whatever. It has to include everybody. So you don't want to adopt a strategy that could be used by the enemy to...
Which strategy doesn't get used by the enemy, Tim?
I think... Huh?
Which strategy doesn't get used?
They're going to try to warp every strategy.
That's exactly right.
As a matter of fact, we're probably infiltrated up to the hilt right now.
More than likely, right? And so,
more than likely, absolutely.
So we are, again, calling out the power structure. And that is an important thing to do. Thank you very much for your call this morning, Tim.
You're welcome, sister. Long life to you.
All right, and to you. Hey, David, you're a white man.
Sure am, yeah.
How does it hit you when we talk about white male supremacy?
I know that when, you know, I hear that sort of thing, that I can acknowledge it without really fully implicating myself in it. Yes, I am the beneficiary of male privilege and the beneficiary of white privilege. And really, the best one can do in terms of that is to acknowledge it and use that privilege for good. And like you said, as a white man, reaching out to other white men to, you know, hopefully turn things around to, you know, empower women and minorities and LGBT people so that, you know, we can begin to have a more just and equitable society. But I feel that George Bush was a white man, so I don't really see any issue in, you know, using the phrase white man. I do think it is somewhat remarkable, though, that there does seem to be a sense, and not to call out the caller directly, I'm referring more generally, that there's a sense of fragility among white men that they do not like to be acknowledged as such,
mm-hmm.
That I don't really fully understand. But, you know, I consider myself as a white man to be, you know, a pretty disempowered white man. But there are, you know, there is a class of white men in this country. Yes, there are powerful black men and Asian men and what have you in the United States, but overwhelmingly the people pulling the levers of power in this country are white men, and I don't see any reason not to acknowledge that and call it out.
Thanks. I appreciate you speaking candidly on that, because you know, again, we're talking about the power structures. We're talking about systemic oppression. And when we're talking about a black woman who is a very, you know, she's been an incumbent now for, I can't remember, 14 terms, that, you know, Maxine Waters, to have her denigrated because she speaks truth to that power structure. And she is a black woman. I think it's important to actually look at the racial and the gender dynamics in the power structure that are at play, because we realize that even dissenting white men get away with a little bit more, and when I say a little bit, I mean a lot, more than women of color, than white women, and than men of color. I think that we cannot deny that, and to deny it is foolish. And it's all about accountability, too, right? We have those that are accorded more privilege, and by virtue of my race, I am. It is important to leverage that privilege to try to effect more social change and to turn the system over. So a little aside there this morning, 503-231-8187. The politics of civility is what we're talking about. My guest is David Hazeltine. You know, David, I've known you for, 12 years or something like it, but I still am not entirely sure how I pronounce your last name. Oh, we have lost David. Dang. Okay, well, we'll have David back in a moment. In the meantime, I want to... hi, David.
I'm back. Yeah, sorry Good. About that.
Oh, you know, these things happen, the wonders of technology being what they are. I had just asked you this burning question, though. I've known you for about 12 years now or something like it, and I still am not entirely sure how I pronounce your last name. Hazeltine or Hazeltine?
You know, it depends on who you ask in the family. I say Hazeltine.
Okay.
But I... Hasseltine, Hazeltine, they all work.
Okay.
Get creative.
I think I've pronounced it three different ways this morning alone, so I just wanted to sort of clear it up. And now let's go ahead and talk to another call. Good morning. You're on the air. Deanna, welcome. Hello, Deanna.
I just wanted to comment on the discussion that you were having around Tim's remarks. And I thought, just as I heard him, I felt something from where perhaps he's coming. And I thought, yes, we need to say not just white men, but bring the class question into it. And I know you understand that, both of you, perfectly well. But maybe just I thought we could think about adopting or saying things the white male power structure or anything like that when we're talking about that, to distinguish it from white males who, yes, are undoubtedly privileged and, yes, are undoubtedly privileged over women as well as everybody else, but still not privileged in the same way that a George W. Bush or anybody like that is. So I'd just like to listen to your comments off the air.
Okay, Deanna. Thanks very much for calling. Well, I want to say, first of all, when I said white men earlier in the conversation, I was actually talking about this administration, right? And I think that was pretty clear. I'm talking about Maxine Waters speaking out strongly against the white men who are in this administration and creating the misery and fascism we see around us. So, first of all, that was the context. Second of all, even if you look at the class issue, and I do, there's intersectionality, right? Intersectionality abounds, and we all have multiple identities. And even so, when you have folks living on the street, no one is getting respected by the cops, right? No one is getting respected. Everyone is being hassled. Everyone is subjected to abhorrent conditions. And you're more likely to be murdered by the cops if, in fact, you're black. So you still retain race privilege. You still retain gender privilege within the class that you are in. And that was that's a hard concept for a lot of people, because it's like, I was born and raised in a working class to poor family. And I, was not really used to thinking of myself as somebody who had privilege in pretty much any way, being a queer woman. But I then have to really reconcile the fact that, yeah, I'm a loudmouth queer woman, and I come from a working class to poor background. No one in my family was able to help me try to go to college or anything like that. And yet, I know that I have had a much easier time than my sisters of color, who are trying to also, and who are also amazing loudmouth queer women, but who don't have the white skin privilege. And there is a further scrutiny that happens, and to deny that is to be complicit in racism, and I refuse.
Hear, hear.
Okay. Thanks for that, David. Let's go ahead and 503-231-8187. We have another caller. Lively topic. I was really hoping people were dying to talk about this morning. Good morning, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for this much-needed discussion. It's really been great. I have kind of a question. I'm trying to remember something, and that is, at some point, Republicans started referring to the Democratic Party in the non-adjective form of the word Democrat and calling them the Democrat Party. Can that sin be laid at the foot of George Bush, or is it someone else?
I don't think so. I don't think that was Bush's. And it's not something I've honestly paid much attention to.
I find it very annoying. And Bush did adopt this kind of Bubba speak, I think trying to affect some kind of Texas accent, which I don't think he ever really
Well, are you talking about? I'm getting the high sign from my board operator Derek this morning, who says that that could be laid on W's feet, but not H's.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's push the
well,
younger.
Anyway. Sorry, I didn't mean to pile on the poor dead guy, but thank you for the show.
But feel free. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we are talking about a family dynasty, you know, it's sometimes hard to keep everyone, you know, to keep their identities separate. I want to go ahead and quote a little bit from The Intercept. Jeremy Scahill has written a piece about his legacy. George H.W. Bush, 1924 to 2018, American war criminal. And I do want to throw this out there because it does, in fact, talk about that family legacy, as well as some of, it's just a small excerpt from the article, The Sins of H.W. George Herbert Walker Bush was an unrepentant war criminal who spent the overwhelming majority of his life making the world a worse place, a more dangerous place, and he leaves behind a global trail of tears, of bloodshed, of death and destruction. His legacy can be seen in the poverty and corruption of Central and Latin America. It can be seen in the never-ending killing fields of Iraq. It can be seen in the international criminals that he pardoned after Iran-Contra and the systemic violence of the so-called war on drugs. This legacy can be seen in the scourge of AIDS, the presence of a sexual harasser, Clarence Thomas, on the Supreme Court, who, in a sick irony of history, replaced Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice and a truly noble man. George H.W. Bush came from a powerful family, who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, to a father who cozied up to the Nazis, who deserted the grave of the, who desecrated the grave of the indigenous leader Geronimo, and whose businesses contributed to the imperial agenda to force the poor of the world into indentured servitude for the powerful. This is, however, that's the eulogy that George H.W. Bush should be receiving this week. Instead, we have this, and then a quote from a newscaster. Throughout his long life, George Bush was admired as a man of decency, modesty, and uncommon achievement, values that to the end reflect what was most important to him, his family. You can see a stark contrast in those two ways of remembering the same person. I know one of them feels a little more accurate to me. Do you have any comments, David?
Just that this whole family is very phony, and it's very, it almost reads like a cover letter or a resume, that last part you read. But one thing I wanted to touch on that our last caller mentioned is that, you know, this Bush tried to affect this Southern drawl, and his son did it as well. Yeah. Actually, both of them in Texas and Florida, respectively. But I grew up in a small town in Connecticut, not far from New Haven, where a lot of the Bushes went to college. And, you know, Prescott Bush, who got very wealthy in violating the Trading with the Enemies Act during World War II and dealing with the Nazis, would invite your listeners to do some research on that. This is a family that is more associated with Connecticut and Maine, and they always made this great effort to associate themselves with, you know, the ranch lifestyle of Texas, and you know, very much like wearing the cowboy hat, and you know, Bush would take people down to his ranch and show reporters around that he was like a real Texas man. But these are like Yaleys and Maine, you know, private summer home people. These are very privileged people, and I wanted to just remark on that.
I think that is important to remark on. It is an image that they chose to project to be of the common folk. W certainly took that a lot further than H.W. did. They both really wanted that sort of to be wrapped in that folksy, down-home kind of image. That, mm-hmm. that their class background absolutely is in stark contrast with. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Good morning. Michael, you are on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that if you focus on race instead of class, you're missing the point. I'm passing for white, but I'm 10% Indian, you know? So I'm not white. So I know that. And I've known it all along. And but I passed for white. So but I'm aware of my class. It's, I can't get around that because it's what it is.
Uh-huh. Okay. And thanks very much for your call this morning, Michael.
Yeah.
I think that, in fact, what we need to do is focus on the power structure and the intersectionality of class, race, and gender, as that seems to, well, still be the power structure that we have. It is classist, absolutely. It is racist, absolutely. And it is patriarchalist, absolutely. We see the policies that have been going for decades, of which we have actually, you know, I can't let the hour pass. We only have about 9 minutes left, but we can't let the hour pass without also talking about Bush the Elder's contribution to racism and the Willie Horton campaign. Where, you know, again, really using the racism and the consciousness of this country to further his political ends. Combine that with his continuation and more aggressive actions in the war on drugs, and also with his AIDS policies, and we find, in fact, that you know, that he was responsible for a good shot in the arm to racism that we are still absolutely plagued with. The power structure, he reinforced it, he used it. And that's another thing I want to hold him accountable for.
Yeah, absolutely. You go ahead, Ani.
Yeah, no, go ahead, David.
I think, you know, we've had a couple calls about this now, and I think that there might be some frustration just because we don't really discuss class in this country. We sort of believe we live in a classless society, but of course that's not true. Of course there exists an ownership class and a working class in this country, and We shouldn't forget that in our desire to have a more constructive conversation on class and its existence and its implications on all of us, that we also need to be, as you say, focusing on the intersectionality of class, race, gender, all these things. And it's not an either or.
Absolutely. It's everything all at once, because, in fact, this is the power structure that is strangling us. This is the power structure that is creating such devastation. Health crises. I mean, as we look at the crisis in Flint, Michigan, departing a little bit here from Bush the Elder, but looking at the crises, the water issues in Flint, we look again at the intersectionality of class and race. And again, we see this over and over again when we look at environmental justice issues, when we look at most justice issues, right? There's that intersectionality. I could go on, but I don't want to completely leave the topic that we have put before us. But I do think I see a topic coming up in another show in the near future. And I look forward to having that discussion then. I want to remind folks, you are listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland. It is your community radio station. We encourage you to contribute to KBOO and really support programs like this and the programs coming up this morning. You can do that by going to KBOO.fm and clicking on donate. Throughout the week, you can follow along with Positively Revolting on Facebook. You'll find our page, Positively Revolting, or in the Twitterverse, at Positive Revolt. 503-231-8187 is the number to call this morning, and I'm checking in with the transitioning board ops to see, in fact, do we have a call? No. All right, so we have just about 5 minutes to wrap up the show. I'm going to go back to that Intercept article for just a moment, because, in fact, again, it ties into our conversation so well. Jeremy Scahill from The Intercept reports, when an unarmed black man is shot dead by the police, the media is flooded with stories about how they were troubled kids, or how they had criminal records, or how they had used drugs, or they had had run-ins with the law. The pictures used in these stories are often ones where these dead black men are presented as scary or thugs. Journalists probed the life of Trayvon Martin, Mike Brown, Eric Garner. News organizations did everything in their power to smear these people in death with absolutely no regard for their families, no respect for their humanity. If George H.W. Bush was treated the same way as these black men, it would take months of nonstop 24/7 coverage to even begin to describe the tip of the iceberg of the unforgivable deeds that George H.W. Bush committed. Why? Because he committed his crimes as president of the United States, and the nature of his crimes was imperial. He did it with bombs, with tanks, invasions, and coups. And that, again, I just want to make sure that we are remembering the whole man and not just Grampy who wore goofy socks. We have one call. I think we can squeeze them in right now. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me on. As a white male who come from a working class myself, you know, I definitely put my foot in my mouth even on this, you know, Supreme Justice nomination. I felt like there should be, you know, due fair process. That was my opinion. You know, just being a guy who's seen both worlds of, you know, give or take sometimes. But I have to tell you, you know, it's all about the money trail and who has the money, and that's the power structure and the money, and who controls the money and the classes that own have that money. I hear everything about Bush. I mean, to me, I think the dominoes were set up. He's just the guy that really flicked it hard, and it flicked, and it's, you know, right now where it is with the president we have. And I kind of just want to summarize also on the, you know, homeless stuff. You know, guys, I'm very peaceful. I love people. But I tell you, some of these tents are no longer homeless tents. They're kind of what I call drug centers. And I have a mixed feelings now with some of this stuff. And I really am starting to get grossed out. And I think people have to realize that, you know, people are taking drugs into that. And I'll leave it at that.
All right. Yeah, this is good because we're out of time. Thanks, Dan, for your call. We're going to talk about class coming up real soon. That's going to be a show that we have coming on up. Right now we have just about 2 minutes left. And so, David, I want to give you a chance to sort of wrap up your thoughts this morning. I do want to thank you for joining me as we share our outrage over the legacy of Bush the Elder.
Yeah, again, happy to be here. I think, you know, we just to summarize, we really do a disservice to ourselves, to the honest memory of an individual, to our society, when we decide that upon their death, we can only remember the good. We cannot remember the whole person. And I would hope that we would all receive equal treatment, that we would have a fair and reasonable accounting of our actions in the world, because to me, what is a person if not the sum of their actions? And so I think it's only fair that we should all receive equal treatment.
What is a person if not for the sum of their actions? I that is a great note to end on. David, thank you so very much for joining me this morning on Positively Revolting. I want to let our listeners know at 9 o'clock, Pacific Underground is going to be on, followed by the first anniversary of Valley Views, Flashpoints, and finally wrapping up the radio zine this morning with a Radio Geekly. After that, you'll hear music with Moving On, The Song Circle, Roots of Rock and Roll, and then into our evening public affairs programming. Stay tuned to KBOO. Please do donate generously to support your community radio station, KBOO.FM. Click on the donate button and support your community broadcasters. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. Thanks, David, for joining me.
Thank you.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
Yo.
Yo. KABU is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KABU are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KABU has been showing up for over 50 years. Give to KABU today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call 503-231-8032. Support KABU, where music makes the movement.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
And coming up this morning, in fact, in just a few seconds, Pacific Underground welcomes Peter Turias and talks about his alternative history novels, United States of Japan and Mecha Samurai Empire. At 10, Valley View celebrates its one-year anniversary on KABU with stories about the show's origin and plans for a future format. At 10, it's Flashpoints. Well, a little after that, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, we'll hear Radio Geekly, all of which comes to you via the auspices of